Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. Got Denny Ranko back again. Regular listeners know Denny and the problems that he's enduring because of his advocacy for what I like to call right over wrong. We've discussed it before on the program, and I want to let Denny update listeners on what's been going on with his battle for justice against the University of Ottawa and related issues and so on. We had a program Denny was on a month ago, and we discussed it. Another individual from the area, the university, is also being targeted. Truth-telling is a very hazardous preoccupation, a profession, or whatever you want to call it. Going along with the system, no matter how harm it does, gets you lots of support. I like to say about the people I call media scoundrels, lying pays well, and truth tellers are orphaned. Before we get into Denny updating his status, I just want to say a few words about what's been going on in Boston. It happens to be my hometown, which really is not the issue at all. I grew up there way, way back. I finished college in the mid-1950s, so you can see how long ago that was. It certainly was not a perfect situation then, but it was heaven compared to where the things are now, not just in Boston, but across America, because of all the harm caused that America causes at home and abroad. It's a different world than the one I grew up with, and everybody is at least to some degree aware of what's been going on in Boston all week. I wrote 3 articles on it. I've got another one in mind. Well, I've got another one going out tomorrow. I have another one in mind. I'll keep at this as long as there's new information that I feel it's important to tell. I absolutely believe that what went on is a classic black ops, a false flag, and these 2 young brothers who've been vilified, one was killed. I think he was shot in cold blood. The other was shot and critically wounded. He's hospitalized. I don't know how seriously. I think I saw something that said he was seriously hurt. But that's kind of a generic statement. I'm not certain exactly what that means. If we later find out that he died, we'll know he for certain was very seriously hurt. I mean, all kinds of police surrounded him where they found him. You never know the story that's reported in the major media, whether it's right, partially right, or absolutely wrong. But supposedly, a neighbor in a community, in a neighborhood, spotted some blood, I think on a top pollen, a woman said, that supposedly this one brother was hiding under. I don't know how we could, from Monday to Friday, I don't know how we could stay under a tarpaulin. I mean, he's got to eat. He's got to do all the normal things everybody does. Whether he was there just temporarily or what, I don't know. And if he was wounded and bleeding without getting help, he could be in very serious trouble. He certainly would need to get some help. Anyway, the police came en masse. I read another report. Thousands of Boston police and SWAT teams and helicopters and all kinds of stuff, FBI, all kinds of stuff was involved in searching for this guy. Again, most listeners probably know Boston literally was on lockdown. With the communities that were named, one of them I lived in, suburban areas, downtown Boston, all public transportation was shut down. I mean, on a Friday, on a work day, people need to get to work. What do? If they didn't have a car and couldn't get a ride, they didn't go to work. I mean, imagine the entire city shut down for a terrorist threat. No terrorist threat, except for the people in charge that caused it. There's an organization called Kraft International. It's a Blackwater-type firm. These people are hired killers. They know how to kill. They're trained to do it. They're experts in explosives. Absolutely, these types, and maybe the FBI along with them, were involved. I don't think these 2 young kids had anything to do with it. The key question always is, qui bono, what on earth benefit do these young kids have to gain by sending off a couple of bombs at the finish line of the Boston Marathon? Absolutely nothing. The only thing they could cause themselves was a lot of grief. I don't for a minute believe these kids had anything to do with it. One's dead. The other either will perish, or he'll spend the rest of his life in America's gulag. Either way, choose your poison. Well, I absolutely believe it, and there's a certain amount of evidence that's already come out. These Kraft International types wearing the same kind of backpack, dressed in military-style uniforms, and not the kind that ordinary people like me would recognize, but combat boots. They had a cap with a skull on it. I think at least one had a T-shirt on with a skull on it. That's the logo of Kraft International. These people, about 10 of them, were right there at the finish line, the marathon finish line. They backed off away from where the explosions took place. Why would they back off? Maybe they crossed the street or something. Why would they back off if they didn't know what was going to happen? Why did the FBI show up straight away? I mean, were they literally on the outskirts? There was a truck. There were people there with caps on saying FBI. I assume they really were FBI. And they were talking with these Kraft International types. I could go on and on about this. My articles are on my blog. They're on a lot of websites. There'll be a new one I'll put out tomorrow. The title is Anatomy of a False Flag. I call it an American tradition, and it is. It goes back to the Mexican War in the middle of the 19th century. It's astonishing the history most people don't know that is not taught in U.S. school. I never learned this stuff in school. Nobody ever taught me this. I mean, from there to the Spanish-American War to all kinds of other things, the more obvious ones people know, you know, Gulf of Tonkin, 9/11, so on and so forth, the more recent ones. But, I mean, this stuff goes back, my goodness, 170 years or so, Mexican War. I mean, James Polk, the president then, instigated a war against Mexico. And what did America get? Well, Mexico lost half its country. America gained California, parts of New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Wyoming, Colorado. That was the benefit for America. So James Polk knew what he had in mind. He wanted to extend America from sea to shining sea. Well, he happened to wage a war to do it. And there was an issue over Texas. Oh, I don't want to go into that. That's a different topic. There was an issue over Texas. I wrote about it long ago. You know, Texas declared its independence and so on. Anyway, false flags are a U.S. tradition. The Boston bombings, I would say, dare say, is the latest example of how America operates and blames it on innocent kids because their roots are back in either Chechnya or Dagestan. They came to America when they were young kids. They're being branded as Islamo-fascists. America's war on Islam continues, and I just can't imagine what's going to follow from this. I expect the worst. We know what happened post 9/11. At least a lot of people know. The wars that have been waged, they continue. I absolutely believe new ones are planned. The police state laws that were enacted, I wrote a very long article at the end of 2007 on what had been enacted up to that time, including executive orders and a whole lot more that went into place, starting with the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security. We had NORTHCOM reactivate the Northern Command up the Pentagon. The last time that was activated was during World War II. What on earth do we need a NORTHCOM now? Who threatens America anywhere, let alone in the Americas? No one. No one. The only threats are the ones that America invents. It doesn't matter if it's George Bush, Obama, or anybody. It's the same dirty game that goes on, and innocent people are blamed. America needs enemies, individual enemies, so Muslims are the target of choice now. Also, Latino immigrants. Poor people are always a target of choice, especially people of color, and there's a war going on against them. But I expect more police state laws. I expect more wars. I expect the worst. In one of my articles, I said what may follow will be post 9/11 2.0. I think that sums it up. Denny, let me let you jump in, and then maybe a few comments.
I'm fascinated by your commentary, Stephen, and thanks again for having me on your radio show. It's wonderful to be with you. I have great admiration for your devotion and your work and your honesty and how brave you are. So I'm glad to be here.
Well, Denny, it's a great honor for me to have you on, and I know what you're going through, and regular listeners do also, and I'm absolutely outraged by it.
And I've got a lot to tell you about. I've got all kinds of things to tell you about, all kinds of interesting stories and developments and so on. But I want to just stay on the topic that you initiated the show with just for a moment. What I don't understand is why the police would need to shoot a young man who's already been shot, who's bleeding profusely, who's hiding in a boat, why they would need to risk killing him by shooting him again it just seems completely incompetent in terms of police work to me, because he's the main suspect. You want the person to be alive. You want to be able to question him appropriately. You want to make sure that he survives and that he can stand up to a trial, a public trial. You want it to be a public trial. You want scrutiny on the whole affair. You want to understand what's going on in society. Why would you put all of that at risk? Why would these idiots, 1,000 of them, shoot the guy again? I just don't. That makes no sense to me. And that in itself, you know, it pushes us towards the idea, you know, are they just brutally incompetent, or is there a reason behind it?
Oh, you know? Well, I had a line in one of my articles, Steady, dead men tell no tales.
Right.
It's just like the 9/11 bombers. You know, I mean, no, well, the, well, there are people who that incident was blamed on, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's been down at Guantanamo for a very long time. He was tortured in Afghanistan too. But from 9/11, September 11, 2001, to right now, over 11 years later, I mean, this guy still has not had his day in court, and when he gets there, it'll be a military court. So, you
right,
know, I mean,
right.
They'll put out any story they want to put out, Denny, and whenever he wants to say that is an inconvenient truth, it'll be blacked out.
Well, if this young person survives enough to go to trial, there's a good chance they'll try him as a soldier, and it'll be a military court. It'll be completely controlled and private. There'll be no public scrutiny, and so on. That's what I heard in the news. That would be horrendous, you know. I think society deserves to know as much as possible where this comes from, and to understand the phenomenon. So that would be a disaster if they use this crazy law against one of their own citizens, a young person, not even 20, and do it secretly. I mean, that would be very disturbing.
I don't think we will ever, if he survives, Denny, don't think the public will ever hear what he has to say. I mean, not just sound bites that they can chop up and put out any way they want, but if he goes on trial and they can't try him at Guantanamo, one of the brothers, I forget now, yeah, I think one of the brothers was a naturalized U.S. citizen. I'm not certain which one, but if he's tried in a civil court, I suppose they could have a closed trial and not let reporters in. I mean, because this is so high profile, I mean, that would really raise some eyebrows. But if it was an open trial, what I really want to say is I just can't imagine they're going to give this guy his day in court so that his side of the story can come out.
That's right.
Russia Today put on his mother. And another media operation, I forget the name, interviewed his father. Well, they absolutely discounted the official story about him, and I believe them. I mean, I think these just are two kids set up to be patsies, and if it hadn't been them, it could have been somebody else.
Well, we can't know. I mean, unfortunately, we live in such a crazy world where the states that run our lives are at war and are involved in huge crimes, and so it's normal that they would control what we see and the events and what gets told in the media, everything. So you just don't know what to believe. I mean, I think it's naive to believe the mainstream line, of course, is completely naive. I mean, there's greater probability that it's completely false than that there's some truth to it. You know, just in terms of statistics, in terms of the war context in which we're living, we most of us in the middle class don't even realize this, but given the context, the magnitude of the crimes, the amount of money that's involved, the power struggles on the scale of the globe that are involved, there is no reason to believe that our mental environment isn't completely controlled for the benefit of that system. It's a difficult situation. But then as soon as you say those kinds of things, most of the middle class would say you're crazy. It can't possibly be true. Here I am living my life, going to work every day. You can't tell me that, you know, that there is such a great need for everything in my environment to be controlled by the state. So, I don't know.
The best way to avoid not being lied to is to tune out the major media, Denny. Tune out the people I call media scoundrels or scoundrel media.
Yeah.
I mean, these people really are scoundrels.
Oh, I know. I turn it on for 15 minutes or half an hour sometimes in the morning, and I go to the supposedly the most reputable sources, and I hear the most the craziest things. Not even, you don't even have to know the facts. The statements themselves are illogical, you know. And there's they ask questions that have the underlying answers built into the questions, and it's just obscene. There's just no professionalism in the media anymore. It's pretty disturbing.
It really is disturbing.
Or it's about these crazy little things that no one should care about. You know, this is, you know, the classic cat caught up in a tree. But it's that kind of thing with just all kinds of nutty things about various murders and stories and kidnappings and all these family feuds and stuff like that, you know.
Well, it really is a great, great shame. And I mean, literally, Western media. There are examples of real, honest media around the world. In Venezuela, Denny, the corporate media dominates something like 90% of what people read or watch on television, and state media, Telesur. State media gets at most 10%, and I mean, they're putting on programming that would be of interest to people. I'm certain they put on real news programs. It's a shame that most Venezuelans don't spend more time watching it and listening to it, but this is where you can get real news. But Britain, BBC, Canada, CBC, I mean, these are state-controlled operations, and they're certainly not going to say anything too nasty about their own governments.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, it's sad. Listen, let me give you a bit of an update on my side, okay?
Oh, I am dying to hear it.
There's so much going on. I mean, there's so much going on. In fact, that's one of the things they're doing to me these days, is they're really putting the crunch on to not allow me the time I need to properly make my case and defend myself, you know, in my court battles. They're doing what is called case management, which means a judge actually decides what you have time to do and when your deadline should be. And so both sides make arguments as to how much time they need. So the other side, like a kind of recording machine, will always say, this is just an unending delay tactic, you know. And the judges actually believe that crap, even though it's just repeating these phrases, you know. And I say, well, look, Your Honor, you know, I've got all these things to do. I've got four motions all at once. I've got submissions for your various orders I have to put in. I've got my labor arbitration coming up that will take a 2-month block. I explain all these things, and then the judge just assigns a date where I have to produce a 50-page document and then stand up in court and defend myself. With virtually, you know, I'm not a team of lawyers. I'm one person, self-defended with no resources. So imposing deadlines is as good as saying, you know, we won't hear you and you won't get a fair trial. And that's what's going on. So for the first time in 2 years since this main civil action's been ongoing, I've just said, no, I can't. I can't meet that deadline. I said, you know, Your Honor, you're asking me to do something that's impossible. You're directing me to do an impossible thing. You want me to prepare my case, and I don't have the transcript from the hearing where, you know, the evidence for the case. I don't have it. The court reporter didn't produce it yet. I can't prepare my case. I mean, this is not a difficult thing to understand, and they just don't care. They assign the date anyway, and they say, well, I'll assign the date, and the other judge on that date will decide if you should go ahead or not. So therefore, you have to submit your documents without having the transcript of evidence. I mean, it's that kind of insanity. And you ask them to reconsider, and you point out again that you don't have the transcript, and they don't care. And then you find out, which I did in this case, that the other side pressured the court reporter to give them parts of the transcript that were not certified, that were not authenticated. The court reporter gives it to them without telling me. then the other side uses it in their motion material, in evidence, while not saying that it's not a certified copy, and while not giving everything that they were given by the reporter, only the pages that serve them. And the page, the next page where they cut it off was saying the opposite of what they were advancing, okay? And it was saying what I was saying. And all this without my knowledge, and then all of a sudden I get the court documents, and there it is, the transcript I've been trying to get for months. And so I call the court reporter, and I said, what's going on? And only after I call him, and only after do I find out that he admits in this phone conversation that he gave it to them, and that it's a draft version, it's not even certified, which is, you're not supposed to, that's against the ethics of how these processes are run. You're not supposed to even release a draft copy, never mind use it in court. So then I made a formal complaint about this reporter, and thankfully the supervisor of the reporters at the court took my complaint very seriously and is looking into it and is really getting to the bottom of it. But this is very disturbing. And then I pointed this out because the court reporter knew he'd done something wrong, so he gave me the evidence. He showed me the emails where they were pressuring him to release this material, and he showed me exactly what he'd given them, and so I was able to see what they did not include that he'd given them. And I reported that to the judge at my next hearing, and the judge didn't want to hear it. He refused to look at the document in which I put that in. He just wouldn't, and in fact, he yelled at me. The first thing he did was to yell at me, arguing that the case that would have involved me exposing that, I should simply be thrown out, that I was, doing things improperly and so on. And I just held my ground, and he backed off, and then I made my case on the other motion that was foreseen for that day. But it just... I'm telling this story that may not make sense to you and your listeners, but I'm just trying to give you a flavor for all the backroom shenanigans and the what I would call unethical behaviors of various court officials and lawyers that go on all the time. You know?
It makes an awful lot of sense to me. They've rigged the game against you. You're going up against, I think, the two top law firms in Canada, or at least one of them. There's Deepak.
No, two of them. There's two of them.
And University of Ottawa is paying all the expenses for your adversary. Doesn't matter how much money you spent. You're on your own. The judge is against you. The procedures are against you. They have literally mocked you for being defeated. I mean, again, they've rigged the game against you,
yep.
and people need to understand that. And the idea of getting there's no way to get justice in America unless you're part of the system. Well, the same thing is true in Canada.
Yeah. Well, it certainly feels like what you're saying, and it certainly appears to be that from my perspective, for sure. I tallied up how much the University of Ottawa, my former employer that fired me, has spent suing me in this way. They have spent well over $500,000 to date. We're not even at trial. We're just doing preliminary motions. Okay? They're just setting up the game so that I can't have a fair trial, is the way I would put it. And they've spent $500,000 on that. Okay? More than. So that's the kind of imbalance of resources that we have here. But let me tell you about a little victory that I had recently. You still there, Steve?
Yeah. Oh, I'm listening.
Yeah. You remember, I think I told your listeners that I tried to go to the Supreme Court of Canada because I had asked a judge to recuse himself for a reason related to his bias. And I had strong evidence, I thought, that there was at least an appearance of bias, and the court wouldn't hear my argument. I was never allowed to explain why I wanted this judge to recuse himself on this, what's called reasonable apprehension of bias. And because the court didn't allow me to be heard, then I went to what's called a leave to appeal. I asked for leave to appeal to the same court, and they didn't allow me an appeal. And so because they didn't allow me an appeal, I looked at the case law and I realized that the rules were such that I would never get an appeal and that I could never be heard on this very important question. I mean, you make a complaint of bias against a judge, nothing could be more serious. And I wasn't going to be heard. So I went to the Supreme Court of Canada. And I think you know the beginning of this story, which is that the registrar of the Supreme Court of Canada, who is a high-ranking lawyer, the highest-ranking official in the court, he said, I'm not even going to accept your documents. I'm not even going to assign a file number to this. Basically, the other side, the two big law firms, argued that he didn't need to accept my documents, that my arguments were so weak that the court didn't have jurisdiction to hear my case, that the Supreme Court didn't have jurisdiction of what they argued, and that my arguments were so weak, it was so obvious he could just not file my documents, so it would never be heard by the judges of the Supreme Court. Well, the registrar went ahead and sent back my documents and said, I'm not going to file this. So then I think I told you this part of the story, but I'm coming to the new part soon, but I want your new listeners to understand the situation. But so then I did what's called a motion to a single judge of the Supreme Court of Canada, asking the judge to review the registrar's decision because it's against the law in my book. You know, there's something called the Supreme Court Act, and he violated that act, in my opinion. So I did a motion to get a judge to examine the situation and overturn the registrar's decision. Well, guess what? The registrar refused to file my motion. The registrar himself refused to file my motion about reviewing his own decision. What could be crazier than that? So then you know what happened, and this is where the new part comes in. Did I tell you the story beyond this point the last time? I can't remember.
I don't think so, Denny. I'm eager to hear it.
Well, here we go. The Ontario Civil Liberties Association stepped in. You know, I made them aware of what was going on. They stepped in, and they wrote an incredible letter to the Chief Justice of Canada saying, listen, look at what the registrar has done. You need to investigate this, and we're on this case, and we need to hear what's going on because this appears crazy to us. Of course, I'm paraphrasing, but it was a very powerful letter. It's up on the internet. It's easy to find at if you search my name and the various cases that are happening. It's up at the Ontario Civil Liberties Association website. It's one of their campaigns, and all of the documentation is there. So they wrote to the Chief Justice, and that was about a month ago. Well, the Chief Justice didn't acknowledge their letter, didn't respond right away, but something else happened. The registrar, out of the blue, this is like a month or two later, writes me a letter and says, puts the other parties, the other two big law firms in CC, and says, Mr. Roncourt, I just want to clarify my previous letters. If you want to bring your materials to me, I will file them, and I will immediately put them before a panel of three judges of the Supreme Court of Canada. So somebody realized that a serious mistake had been made, and the registrar himself said, well, we'll take it now, okay? And so then, the next day, I just took the documents that they had returned to me. I brought them right over to the court. I asked to meet the chief manager at the receiving office, and I said, here they are. And boy, they knew who I was, and they were expecting me. And they said, yes, Mr. Roncourt. And they took them, and then I asked them, you know, how did this happen? I asked about their internal procedures, because I wanted to know what their internal procedures were related to how I'd been treated the first time. And they said, well, we don't give our internal procedures. And I said, well, I'm asking you to give them to me. Yeah, as a question, it's a question of transparency, and I want to know. So she said she would ask the registrar if she could, and she'd get back to me. But more importantly, they assigned a file number immediately, and it's going before the judges of the Supreme Court. So I will at least be heard at that level, at the highest court in Canada, to determine whether or not I can appeal to the highest court of Canada the fact that I was never heard on my complaint of bias against a judge of the lower court. So that in itself is a small victory because the two top law firms argued strenuously with the registrar that the Supreme Court did not have jurisdiction and that it was perfectly okay to deny my application and deny my motion to review the registrar. They argued that point as well. They made submissions to that effect, and the registrar sided with them, and then all of that has been, the clock's been turned back on that, you see. So that's at least fixed for now.
Denny, I really wish you well. I don't know how the Canadian Supreme Court works. It is mighty hard in America to get their attention. And when we come back, I'll read you a one-liner that they usually tell people who appeal to the highest court when the court does not want to take the case.
Right.
But let's take a quick break. Hold your thought where you are, and then you can pick up where you left off when we come back.
Oh, yeah, I've got a different story for when we come back.
Okay. Talking with Denny Rancourt about his legal battle for justice, and I emphasize justice, and Denny mentioned in the first half of the program, for regular listeners who didn't hear what he said before or may have not read several articles I wrote about Denny, Denny was dismissed from the University of Ottawa for doing the right thing, for being an exceptional teacher. Those were the words of his students. He supported Palestinian rights. He literally supported right over wrong, which is the way I like to sum it up. And that's not the way the University of Ottawa runs things, or so much else in Canada, the establishment in Canada, whether it's government, academia, whatever, and in America, in Western society overall. Doing the right thing is a very hazardous thing. It's very, very hazardous. Denny, I'll read you. It's a quick one-liner.
Yes.
That the U.S. Supreme Court sends to litigants wanting to be heard before the court. When
yes.
they turn them down, it simply says, it's titled Opinion, Petition for Writ of Certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, denied. Well,
exactly. Canada, the Supreme Court of Canada does exactly the same thing. On a leave to appeal, you get a message of the type, leave to appeal denied.
No explanation, nothing else.
No. The law says they don't have to give a reason. It's unbelievable, but that's the way it is.
Well, so I asked a lawyer who petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court. She sent me this, and she said, yeah, well, I mean, they just send you this one line, and they don't tell you anything. So you
right.
have no idea if you had a, I mean, she had a real legitimate case, and they
right.
just turned her down flat.
You see, if the Supreme Court does this in my case, because now there's three judges that are going to look at my documents, and I've been told that my documents are exceedingly well put together. The legal arguments are very strong. It's a very clear case that I was not heard on my complaint to the court that a judge was, that there was an appearance of bias there. So if they turn me down, they'll be saying this. They'll be saying it's possible for a litigant to never be heard when he wants to be heard in order to demonstrate that the judge before him is apparently biased. Because, you know, in the legal system, an appearance of bias is as serious as true bias itself. It's treated legally exactly the same way. So if people generally would think that there's bias given the circumstances and the facts, then that's as solid as actual bias in the judge's mind. So that's what this is about, and it will mean that the Supreme Court will be saying, yep, that's right, at the lower court, you can never be heard on a question of bias. So we'll see.
Well, Danny, you are really putting up a very, very heroic struggle. It's the reason that I really want to keep talking about this on this program. I mean, people like you really deserve justice. I mean, you literally put so much at risk in doing what was right, and the hammer has come down on you so hard. It just appalls me that this kind of stuff happens. Well, you know, you and I are alive, Denny. We didn't go through what these poor kids in Boston went through, and so many others are the victims of America's imperial wars. A lot of it to Canada is allied with Afghanistan, and I don't think Canada was in Iraq, but I believe, does Canada still have forces in Afghanistan?
I don't know the details of that.
I think maybe small numbers of forces.
Probably.
But basically,
yeah.
Basically, Canada allies with America's imperial agenda, and millions of people suffer.
Yeah. You know, just today, Stephen, I got an email just now, like minutes before the start of the show, from one of the many people that came to see me in court on Wednesday of this week, where I fought a motion. And at the start of the session, the judge was, you know, putting on this show that he was very angry with me, and he was screaming at me. And he was telling me, you know, how is it possible that you've submitted all these documents in one motion and no documents in the other motion? Well, you know, how is it possible? One motion was started months before the other, and I had actual time to put the documents together, whereas the other one I didn't even have the transcript to be able to put the transcript together. But anyway, never mind. So he was just going berserk on this idea that there were two motions before him, and one had the documents and the other I wasn't able to produce them. So they get very angry, and they're very intimidating. And so this person wrote to me just now, and, you know, we filled the courtroom with people who came to see me and to lend their support. So it's a very moving, and many of the people that came out are my former colleagues, professors at the University of Ottawa, and they're getting interested in this, you know. And one of them wrote this. She said, "These visits to the court are a real learning experience. It is not a minor thing to be able to find out about things that transcend the courtroom and that have to do with, quote, the establishment at work, end of quote, as you say." And then she goes on to say, "You were really focused, and more than that, it is very rewarding to see someone who stands firm and does not bend in the face of power, but on the other hand, does not respond with aggression. Such a position or role is so difficult to maintain, but in these kinds of responses to oppressive behavior lies the hope of a better future. So, we thank you also for the opportunity to see that attitude is possible, even though it might not bring success in the short term. It is a success in itself." So that was a message I just got about someone who was in court on Wednesday watching how I was able to defend myself.
Danny,
so you
wonderful.
See, my battle is affecting the lives of many people. I've had many students say that they had no idea that the courts could be anything like this. And they're writing articles in the student papers, they're writing articles on their blogs about how imbalanced this battle is and just how unfair it appears to them, the way the judges appear to be siding with the top lawyers all the time in their demeanor, in their reactions, in the strength of their voice, and how they interrupt me but never interrupt the other side, you know, all these kinds of things. And so it's being reported on. And so I wanted to read that note to you. But now I want to tell you about something else. I want to tell you about my firing, my dismissal case, because the last hearings in my dismissal case are going to occur in May and June. And then after that, the arbitrator, the judge, if you like, is going to go away for 4 to 6 months, typically, and decide whether I was justly fired or not, and if I'm allowed to go back, and so on, and if reparations are due to me, and if the university acted in bad faith or not, which is what my union is saying. So, that's happening, and I can tell you, as I prepare for those hearings, it's a crazy case. I feel like I'm in a Kafka nightmare. The university has made it clear that it is going to argue that even if they were not right to dismiss me, I should not be allowed back on campus. That's the main thrust of their position. Maybe we fired him incorrectly, but he's such a dangerous character that we can't allow him back on campus with students. That's what they're going to argue. They're going to argue, basically, that I'm corrupting the youth. This is a modern, a great friend of mine who passed away not long ago, the renowned historian of technology and science, David F. Noble. He was a real supporter of me, and he used to say that I was a modern case, that I was a modern Socrates, because they're accusing me of corrupting the youth. Because what they're doing is they're going and looking at my articles and my published materials, and they're saying, look, here's evidence that we can't have this guy back on campus. He has these ideas. So it's truly about, your listeners probably know about Socrates, you know. In 399 B.C., there was the trial of Socrates, and he was accused of corrupting the youth, and the penalty was death by poisoning. And the jury found him guilty, and he was possibly one of the greatest philosophical minds of all time. But he had to go through that because he was critical of the powers of the state at the time, and he made a lot of enemies, and they ended up setting up this show trial and killing him, basically. So it's a modern case like that because the university is actually bringing out these articles I've written and pointing to them and saying, you see, he promotes violence. He's for violence, you know, because I've been writing articles where I'll explain the reasoning behind the kind of destruction of property that can occur at a major demonstration against the G20, for example, like happened in Toronto. And I'll explain the logic of that in the mind of the protester. And so they'll take that and my strong language and they'll make it into, you know, here's someone who's promoting violence on the campus. So they actually go and get your ideas. And so I've been going through the exercise recently of looking at my own writings so I can quote myself to them to prove to them that I'm not an agent of violence, that I'm an agent of progressive change, and that's what I believe. And that's the kind of exercise that I've been doing just to prepare myself for these crazy arguments that they've announced. They actually argued at the beginning of the hearings a year ago that they were going to use my post-dismissal behavior, which means the articles I wrote and the things I might have done and the talks I might have given after I was dismissed, as an argument for why it was right to dismiss me. They actually said that on the record. It's quite remarkable stuff, and there's a YouTube video of the lawyer saying that, which the students posted on the internet. So I'm getting ready for that, and it's going to be a hard battle, but it's going to be all about how it's all about ideas and indoctrination and freedom of speech outside in your interactions in society, and how that is enough to not allow you to be a professor on a campus. That's where we're at.
I understand exactly what you're saying because I do so much writing myself. There is nothing in any of my articles that endorses violence. I endorse protest. I endorse resistance. I stress so often in articles on air that I deplore violence. I prefer nonviolent protest. This is the way to get results. Enough of it can get results, but anybody could twist what I write and say, just the way they're doing it to you, to say that I endorse violence.
Yeah.
I've made comments that we need a revolution. I'm not endorsing a violent revolution. A revolution means change. That's what it means. The word radical means change. It doesn't matter throwing bombs or shooting people, but these rogues can twist our words any way they want to do it and hold it against us and maybe get a right-wing judge to go along with it. or an intimidated jury.
They're clearly counting on it. It appears to be, from what they've announced and from their opening statements, it's going to be the main thrust of their argument. And so they're hoping that the arbitrator is, of a conservative mind and will be swayed by those kinds of arguments, at least to prevent me to come back on campus. And if they're successful in that, it will be a modern case where a professor is barred, even though he was unjustly fired, barred from his profession and from his teaching and from interacting with students and the university community on the basis of what he has written, on the basis of the words on the page and the opinions about social change, about real interactions, clashes in society. And yes, I use radical language, radical in the sense it goes to the root of problems, and I'm not afraid to say things and use terms that get people thinking and that will upset many, many players and many people. And I also criticize activists. I criticize activists when I think that their methods are not efficient or are not authentic. I've made a lot of people very unhappy with my many, many criticisms. But they're going to be using that, as far as I can see, as their key arguments as to why there's just no way they can sanely allow me back on campus. It's a case of that type. Isn't that something? Here we are more than 2,000 years later, and we're still at that level.
It's astonishing, Denny, and the amount of money that they have invested in absolutely beating up on you is astonishing. Think of what the good that they could do with that money by putting it into the curricula, by doing things for students, for making the University of Ottawa a better place, and instead they're using this money. And, of course, the president, Alan Rock, is a former political operative, a U.N. ambassador of Canada to the U.N. ambassador, Canada's U.N. ambassador, and so on. I mean, this guy is a real rogue. The solution is to get rid of him and get a legitimate academic person in charge of running the university and issue an apology to you, welcome you back, reinstate you, and pay damages, because they've certainly done enormous damage to you.
Yeah, no, it's been very, very harsh, and I've been under extreme duress for many, many years as a result of this. I mean, it's a banishment. They actually, when they barred me from campus before I was even fired, when I tried to go back to do my weekly seminar series, for the public, they handcuffed me and took me away.
Mm-hmm.
The police, they called the police, and they took me away in cuffs and charged me with trespass. And it's a charge that I beat in court, in the sense that it was dropped when I asked for the evidence and when I asked to be allowed to make my case to prove that I was still a professor and that it was that I was allowed to be there because of my position and that their banning was not legitimate, because they had even acknowledged that I was still supervising an employee. And they were allowing that employee on campus, provided I was there. And at the same time, they were trespassing me and getting me arrested in front of, the entire class, the public that had shown up for this event. Anyway, it was very disturbing. And everything in the way that they operated has been disturbing. The way they fired me, they called me to a meeting and they refused to tell me what the meeting would be about. I was a full professor with tenure, had a big laboratory, world recognition in my various areas of research. Everybody loved my teaching and so on. They called me in and they wouldn't tell me why, and they said, you must be there. And so it was an order to be there, and I just went to this meeting, and they said, you're fired, and there's police waiting outside, and they're going to take you away, and you can never come back on campus. And, they can't fire you on the spot. What they said is, we're recommending that you be fired, and until the process is done, you're off campus. And so it was very disturbing how they did it, and so any time I wanted to come back on campus, according to them, I had to be accompanied by police. If I wanted to come and see my union representatives, there was a student who graduated, one of my graduate students defended his thesis, I had to have a special permission, and I had to be accompanied by police in full gear to the examination of this thesis, and then I asked for, the student asked for a special permission that I be allowed to join them at the pub afterwards, because there's a special ceremony that's part of the tradition there where we, there's a special mug for the student that graduates. The student had to basically beg the vice president academic to have me allowed there, and I was accompanied there by police to the pub. I mean, it's very disturbing stuff. This is how they treat you.
Denny, if that isn't a definition of a police state, I don't know what is.
Yeah, yeah. Especially when, you know, what is the evidence that I'm that dangerous? What has brought them, what can possibly justify that kind of treatment of a professor? You know, what was it that made them this crazy, you know? My writings, basically. And their idea that when you criticize the system and when you show up at the Senate to give your opinion and be critical, or at various committee meetings, which I was doing regularly, that is such a threat, that it's such an example of defiance, that I must be crazy. You know, that's how I understand their logic. You know, I would write letters to all of my colleagues on campus. I would write emails, and I would say, you know, look at what the president's doing, and look at what the university's doing, and look at these decisions. And, you know, I was very defiant, and they did not appreciate it. And this is what they decided to do. They decided to take me out, develop a pretext in relation to you. Well, your listeners have heard the pretext many times that they use, but it was about how I was grading students in one class, and they decided that was enough to fire me. As, you know, that even as a pretext, if it were true, that would be enough, they decided. And so that's how legally they did it. But
they have to come up with something, Denny. When there's nothing to come up with, they invent something. And again,
yeah.
I quoted your students calling you an exceptional teacher. I mean, you stress the notion that the teaching, the idea of teaching is to get students to learn. And your students learned. What else is teaching all about?
Yeah, yeah. No, I wasn't even able to have that discussion with my dean, you know. I spent months just asking him on a regular basis, can we just meet and talk about this? You know, will you let me explain how I teach and what I'm teaching and how I'm doing this? And will you come into the class and see it for yourself? And so on. And he wouldn't. At first, he wouldn't even acknowledge my calls, and then in the end, he said he wouldn't. So there was no dialogue. There was just an assumption that I was a dangerous, probably crazy person. I mean, they actually wrote me a letter at one point and basically said I was crazy. They said, the way they say it is, they say, we're concerned about your mental and physical health. And is there anything we can do to accommodate any troubles you might have with your mental health? Hmm. They once sent me a letter of that type.
That really is incredible. Denny, we're out of time. A quick last thought.
Oh, I was going to tell you about how that letter came about. But it'll be another day's story.
It'll be another day's story. Denny, absolutely. I mean, this is an ongoing story. It's a horror story. I hope in some way, big or small, it has a happy ending, Denny. And I absolutely make this program open to you so that people know how terribly you've been abused. I'll email you off air, and I look forward to having you back.
Well, people can just Google my name, or they can go to your radio station and see my name there, and they'll be able to trace. You have to be a little bit, you know, there's a lot of material there, but you'll find some key blogs and some key sites with documents, and the Ontario Civil Liberties Association has some good material as well.
Oh, there's a lot of good material, and if listeners don't know quite how to reach you, they can reach me. My email address is on the bottom of every article I write. Google Lindman. I will send you information on how to reach Denny. We all owe you support, Denny, because today your travails, they could be ours tomorrow. Denny, many, many thanks.
I'll wish it on you. Listeners,
tune in again tomorrow, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern. Make it a regular habit.